This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie. One thing I've learned is that you buy a house, but you make it a home. And for decades, Angie's helped millions of homeowners hire skilled pros for the projects that matter. Get all your jobs done well at Angie.com.
You open the fridge. There's nothing there. So what's it gonna be? Greasy pizza? Sad drive-thru burgers? Dish by Blue Apron is for nights like that. These are the pre-made meals of your dreams. At least 20 grams of protein. No artificial flavors or colors. No chopping, no cleanup, no guilt. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Sometimes we are given tremendous opportunities, and today is one of those days at 10:07 here at WILK. We are welcoming to our show Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, the author of a new book, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. Dr. Hanson, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you for having me.
It is wonderful for you to be here to talk about a topic of great significance and a topic that's been discussed, let's face it, many, many times. But you have a different kind of approach to this book. So talk a little bit about why you wanted to write about World War II, which has been written about many, many times, and your very distinct approach to it.
Yes, there's 8,000 books a year that come out on World War II. Well, I tried to arrange it not by chronology, but by the way it was fought on the land, on the sea, in the air, and then tried to describe whether the decisions of the Axis or allies to build things like a V-1 rocket or a super battleship like the Yamato were stupid, wise, or didn't matter. I also called it the Second World Wars plural because my argument was until the invasion of the Soviet Union and Pearl Harbor and the German declaration of war against the United States, all that happened in 1941. It wasn't known as World War II. It was just known as successful German wars, nine of them against Norway, France, Greece, Yugoslavia, and they won all of them. The world was basically at peace in May 1941, and then Hitler and the Japanese opened a whole new front against Russia and the United States and Britain and the Pacific, and suddenly people said, you know, this is something new. And the British called it the Second World War. We called it World War II, and they renamed the Great War World War I. And so I try to bring that out, and then I try to explain why the Allies won so quickly after 1941. They won within 3 years. Global existential war.
Yeah, I guess in standard conflicts like the one that we've been in since 01, that is very short. But the casualty count, Dr. Hanson, I think, something that people forget. I mean, there was just such a massive, massive amount of death in this war, and many civilians, by the way.
I think we forget that. It's been 75 years since, say, 1942, and 76 since 41. Even longer since it broke out in 39, but it was the largest catastrophe in the history of human experience. 60 to 65 million people died within 6 years. 27,000 people died every single day of the war, more than Afghanistan, Iraq put together by a factor of five. And we forget that it was the first major war. There were far more civilians got killed of that 65. 50 were not in uniform or not armed of the 65 million. And it was the first major war where the losers, the Germans, Japanese, Italians, lost far more than the winners. In some ways, the war was just a story of German soldiers and Japanese soldiers killing 50 million people who were not armed or not in uniform in three places. Russia, 27 million dead. Eastern Europe, about 9 to 10 million dead. And China and the Pacific, about another 15 to 20 million dead, depending on which account we choose to trust. So it was a very strange war, but we have it all, you know, we don't think of it that way, that Germans and Japanese were killing about seven times more civilians than each soldier or civilian they lost. And they did it without much opposition in China and the Pacific, at least originally. And I think we need to really think back when we hear revisionist history about Dresden or Hiroshima to see what was the context of those Allied retaliations. And it really was to stop this killing machine that would kill 50 million people.
Let's talk about the leadership of Adolf Hitler. And as you mentioned, the Germans must have felt pretty emboldened with their success rate, right? They must have felt that they could dominate based upon what happened in the past. Where was Hitler stupid wise, and where didn't it matter in his planning, his strat planning with his people?
Well, he had a hunch that even though the Allies of that time, Britain and France, had larger armies combined and more GDP and better weapons, they really did. But he felt that after World War One, they were exhausted. It was kind of ironic that the winners didn't ever want to repeat that ordeal, but the losers surely did and try it again and win the next time. So British appeasement and French appeasement encouraged Hitler that even though they had greater resources, they wouldn't use them. Britain still had the largest navy in the world. And then when you add in the Russians after August 23rd, 1939, were actively colluding. Stalin had made a non-aggression pact. And the final piece in that trifecta with the United States was isolationist. So in Hitler's mind, he thought the British and French don't want to fight. The Russians are going to help me and supply goods and munitions and everything from oil to wheat and protect my eastern flank. And the United States will never come in like they did in World War One. And that gave him a lot of confidence. And then when his generals still didn't want him to invade because they were traumatized by World War One. But after he defeated the Poles and the Norwegians and the Danes and the Belgians of Luxembourg and the Dutch and the French and the Yugoslavs and the Greeks, he thought he was unstoppable. And what he didn't calibrate was Russia was huge. It was 180 million people. They had no European roads. It was far from Germany. And Blitzkrieg, that term we use for his lightning surprise attacks, wouldn't work against the Russians. And he had no ability to get to the United States, either to bomb Detroit or San Francisco or land, much less land on the North American continent. And the Blitz had failed to knock Britain out of war. And so he really started an existential war with no means of attacking the will or the power to make war of his enemies. And that was quickly realized within 3 years, that blunder.
Let's talk about our entry into this war, which obviously was through Pearl Harbor and that attack. How reluctant, Dr. Hansen, was the United States at this point? I mean, World War One was very devastating to us, and I guess a lot of people saw, we were, like you just said, you know, these places were so far away from the United States, but then all of a sudden we had this, and I'll ask you this because some people dispute it. What was the attack on Pearl Harbor truly the sneak attack that FDR talked about in his speech to Congress?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, there's a lot of revisionist history that say that we, with a wink and a nod, knew they were coming, but we didn't really. I mean, they did the impossible. We couldn't do it, even when the Doolittle raid tried to reverse it. That was a 3,000-mile voyage of the Japanese Imperial Fleet in the dead of winter and refueling in radio silence when they came all the way from Tokyo Bay all the way to off 150 miles off Pearl Harbor. It's never been matched, that feat of seamanship. And they really did believe, given the United States had not helped Britain and given that it had not helped France and that the Pacific was wide open because the colonial powers had ceased to exist, the United States would not do anything. And they felt they could catch the aircraft carriers, destroy them, destroy the battleships, and then the United States would sue for peace. And, of course, the carriers were not there, and they didn't hit the oil tanks. They didn't stick around to attack the machine shop. They didn't invade the island, and they had no ability to go another 3,000 miles to hit the shipyards in Oakland or San Diego. So it was just enough to get the United States angry, but it wasn't enough attack of a magnitude to do much to the American ability to retaliate. That's the stupidest thing you can do in a war, is to start a global existential conflict with a power that has 30 times your GDP and over twice your population, and you have no ability to harm it in the long run, but you do have an ability to get it very angry enough to fight back. And the United States already had four-engine bombers, and within 3 years they would have about 12,000 bombers worldwide, and they would be able to bomb Japan from the Mariana Islands.
Let's talk a little bit about the leadership of England under Winston Churchill. Before you came on the show, Dr. Hansen, we were talking about some of our modern-day leadership, and it doesn't seem to be as cerebral and passionate, maybe, as Winston Churchill, who really is a remarkable figure in history, and really, you know, was one of the individuals who really put up during this when others were not apt to. I mean, this guy was an amazing leader.
Yeah, he was. I mean, if he hadn't become prime minister on May 10th, the first day of the invasion of France by Germany, I think that after France fell, most of the British aristocracy would have quit. But he was a geostrategic banker, and he asked himself questions. Is the Luftwaffe capable of knocking out the RAF, the British Air Force? And Germany's Navy, is it able to land troops on Britain? Of course, the answer was no. So he said, why should we give up? And he thought, eventually they'll attack, according to the tenets of Mein Kampf, Hitler's sort of grand vision of world conquest. They'll attack the Soviet Union, and eventually the United States will come in. He saw all that. Hitler and Mussolini, to take two examples, were combat veterans, very brave fighters, but they were corporals, and they had no administrative ability or no strategic vision, whereas Franklin Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy in World War One, and Churchill had been First Lord of the Admiralty, and they could understand how, when you go to war, what are your objectives, what do you want to achieve, and do you have the means to match your agenda? And of course they said, we have to go to Rome, Berlin, and Tokyo and physically eject these governments, defeat and humiliate their people, and demand unconditional surrender, whereas Hitler and Mussolini and Tojo, they had these surprise attacks and declared war, but they had no ability, again, to go into Detroit and destroy B-24 production or the Kaiser shipyards in Oakland or Manchester, England's production of Lancaster bombers. They just, they lived in a world of, I guess we'd call it surreal fantasy.
When you look at today's modern landscape, and oftentimes I'm sure you hear the rhetoric that we are, quote unquote, on the brink of World War III. How do you feel about the climate, and if there is trouble, where do you think it will come from?
Well, I don't think we are on the cusp of World War III, but I think we have to learn from World War II that deterrence, that's the ability to convince an aggressor that it would be stupid to attack. It's not just based on material resources. Britain and France had a greater army, a better air force together, and better ships than Germany. But they didn't convey the will that they would use them after the Munich agreements, for example, and 5 years of appeasement and the isolation of Americanism, isolationist America and the collusion of Russia. But what I'm getting at is Iran and North Korea need to know that our fleet is larger than all the fleets in the world today, and that our nuclear capabilities are greater than any other country, and our conventional forces are greater. And just because we pulled out of Iraq, or we didn't do too well bombing Libya and leaving, or we're in a slog in Afghanistan, is not a true reflection of the United States power and will. So I think what we're trying to do right now is to tell North Korea by shows of force in the Pacific, or tough rhetoric, or even acting a little crazy and unpredictable, and Iran is watching all this, that it's a very stupid thing to attack the United States because it will result in your destruction. But I think over the last 10 years or so, for a variety of reasons, both rhetorical and actual, people got the impression that the United States was very strong, but it would either could not or would not express that strength, and they developed a certain contempt, whether it was reset with Russia or the Spratly Islands bases that China built illegally in the South China Sea, or the Iranian deal, or the pullout from Iraq, or ISIS as a JV organization, the Cairo speech. I'm not trying to pick on the Obama administration, because Bush made a lot of mistakes as well. But I guess the impression that was created is that we were very strong, but we were not going to use that strength. And throughout history, that earns a particular contempt from aggressors who say, well, if I had their power, I would really attack people, but they're not even willing to defend their interests. I don't think that's quite accurate, but that doesn't matter. It's the impression that these aggressors have.
What do you think about the leadership of President Trump? He just came back from this big international trip. Where is he going right, and where is he going wrong?
Well, the leadership is, in the modern American state, foreign policy consists of about five people. The president, who sets the tone, obviously, but this president was the first not to have either political or military experience, so he has given much more latitude to his lieutenants, and those are Nikki Haley at the UN, Rex Tillerson at State, H.R. McMaster as a National Security Advisor, Jim Mattis at Defense, and Mike Pompeo at CIA. And I think those are excellent people, and I think they play sort of the role of good cop, and they benefit, or they use Trump's unpredictability, and they leverage people, and they say, you know, we don't know what Trump is going to do, but you, so you better be careful, but if you want to cut a deal or you want to talk, we're here to define or elaborate or contextualize what Trump wants. And that, I know that sounds a little crazy, but throughout history, unpredictability and erratic behavior sometimes, if it's in measure and control, seeds doubt, which is good. But if you're always predictable and you're always going to apologize, or you're always going to say you won't use force, whether it's Dean Acheson explaining to the communist Chinese in 1950 that we would not protect South Korea, or April Glaspie in 1990 telling Saddam Hussein we just don't care about an Arab dispute between you and Kuwait, or the British saying, you know, we'll take a minesweeper out of the Falklands to reassure Argentina. The irony is that sober and judicious way of assuring aggressor is much more dangerous than calling somebody Rocket Man off the cuff.
Interesting stuff. Dr. Hansen, what a great topic. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
About your book, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. Dr. Victor Davis Hansen is a contributor to the National Review and a really smart guy, so thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Making plans with asthma can be awful. It always goes from, that sounds fun, to, in this weather, what if my asthma acts up? I got tired of saying no, so my doctor suggested Dupixent. I'm Rachel, and I'm sponsored by Regeneron and Sanofi to share my story with real patients like me.
Dupixent, dupilumab, is an add-on prescription maintenance treatment for adults and children 6 years and up with moderate to severe eosinophilic or oral steroid-dependent asthma that's not controlled with current asthma medicines. Dupixent is not for sudden breathing problems.
Dupixent helps people breathe better in as little as 2 weeks. And now, I don't even think twice about saying yes to plans more, rain or shine.
Severe allergic reactions, including skin reactions, can occur. Get help right away for face, mouth, tongue, or throat swelling, wheezing, or trouble breathing. Tell your doctor right away of signs of inflamed blood vessels like rash, chest pain, worsening shortness of breath, brown or dark-colored urine, tingling or numbness in limbs. Tell your doctor of new or worsening skin symptoms, joint aches and pain, or a parasitic infection. Don't change or stop other treatments without talking to your doctor.
Do more with less asthma. Ask your asthma specialist about Dupixent by name. Visit Dupixent.com or call 1-844-DUPIXENT.
Oh, could this vintage store be any cuter?
Right? And the best part? They accept Discover.
Accept Discover? In a little place like this? I don't think so, Jennifer.
Oh, yeah, huh? Discover's accepted where I like to shop. Come on, baby, get with the times.
Right, so we shouldn't get the parachute pants?
These are making a comeback. I think.
Discover is accepted at 99% of places that take credit cards nationwide. Based on the February 2025 Nielsen report.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
When it comes to lighting, Graybar goes beyond parts and products. We help contractors turn plans into smart designs, manage kitting and deliverables, and navigate local codes so you can stay on time and on budget. Smart, scalable, job site ready. That's not just lighting. That's like kicking your project into Graybar mode. Yep, Graybar does that.